Connecting.
Stories.
Sound.
Science.
Technology.
Documentaries.
RN.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/RN. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, Year Zero, a history of 1945. According to academic, author and historian Ian Buruma, 1945 was a pivotal year, not only for Europe, but for the world at large. From the ruins and desolation of World War II, new hope emerged, and with it, an opportunity to rebuild, reshape and reimagine society. One legacy from that period is that peace and prosperity has largely prevailed. But is the post-war consensus in danger of unravelling? Ian Buruma's Year Zero is more than just the European experience. He writes about China, Japan, human rights and history, sexuality and murder. And it's not all big-picture analysis. He also considers how people dealt with feelings of revenge, how collaborators were treated, and after the trauma of war, was it possible to return to any sense of normality? On Big Ideas, let's head now to Sydney, where Ian Buruma is joined by RN's Kate Evans to discuss his latest book, Year Zero, A History of 1945. Ian Buruma is Human Rights Professor at Bard College in New York.
Hello and welcome to a conversation about the year 1945. I'm Kate Evans, delighted to be here with academic, historian and novelist Ian Buruma.
Hello.
What was it about your father's experience of the Second World War and what happened on his return that sparked this study, this investigation for you?
Well, he told me a story more than once, and I was always very baffled by it. Which goes as follows. He became a law student at the University of Utrecht in Holland in 1941, I believe it was. And as a dutiful law student, joined the student fraternity. And if you wanted to join the student fraternity, you had to go through initiation rites, which involved a lot of hazing and humiliation and being made to jump around like a frog and so on and so forth. And at the time, Holland was occupied by the Nazis, and they banned student fraternities as potential sources of resistance. Nonetheless, it went on for a bit, and so his initiation took place underground, as it were. He then refused, like most students in Holland, to sign the loyalty oath to the Nazi authorities. And if you refused, you were forced to go and work for the war industry in Germany, unless you went into hiding, which many of them did, including my father. Something went wrong in the student underground. He was told to come back to his hometown, was caught up. The German police threatened that if he didn't sign up for work in Germany, his father would be arrested and so on. So he ended up in Berlin, living through the Battle of Berlin, the bombings that went on day and night. He lived through the Russians almost killing him. He collapsed with starvation and fatigue, was nursed back to some kind of state of health by a prostitute, ended up in a displaced persons camp, finally came back to Holland and joined his university and his fraternity again, only to be told by senior students that since the first initiation in 1941 had taken place in secret, they had to do it all over again. And there were boys who went through worse experiences than my father. I mean, who'd been to concentration camps, and they were also made to hop around like frogs and so on. So I thought, I asked him, I said, how is it possible that you would have put up with this nonsense after having experienced what you had? And he sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, well, we just did. And I thought about this a lot and then thought, well, it's probably because they were yearning for normality and to go back to the world as it had been before this ghastly war so much that this was in some ways a symbol of the old world and a way to slide back into it. And he doesn't disagree.
So as a starting point then for the book, what was it you then wanted to know about that? What that idea of a pre-world normality was, or to investigate whether or how the world had changed forever?
Well, like everything else, it's unfashionable to say so, but of course class had a lot to do with this. Those who had been relatively comfortable before the war were more likely to want to go back to the way things were. Those who were not wanted the world to change. And so if you were a working class soldier in the British Army, and you'd sacrificed a lot during the war, lived through the Blitz and all that, the last thing you wanted in 1945 was for the world to go back to the world represented by Winston Churchill, of being bossed around by an upper class and by toffs. And so the British voted Churchill out and Attlee in because they wanted a more equal world, a welfare state, better housing, and so on and so forth. So I think there were these both these tendencies, which were sometimes in tension, and that some people wanted to go back to the thing the way it had been before, and others wanted the exact opposite.
And in the immediate aftermath, what had happened during the war had to be dealt with in a whole range of different ways. And just sticking with the Dutch experience for a moment, it seems that one of the central things that had to be dealt with was the sort of ambiguous relationship to Germany and what that meant for things like collaboration.
No, it wasn't ambiguous at all. We hated them. And when they beat Holland in 1975 in the World Cup, it was a day of national mourning. And when Holland beat Germany in 1988 in the European Cup, there was more celebration in the streets than on the 5th of May 1945. That shows you how deep these... And now, actually, this is pretty much dissipated, which is a very good thing. But yes, the collaborators, part of the pattern of revenge, not just in Holland, but everywhere, was that vengeance was mostly meted out to your own people, not to the former enemy. So there wasn't much revenge against Germans. There was a lot of revenge against collaborators or people who'd been suspected of collaboration, including a large number of women, of course, whose only sin, which was not a grievous sin, but it added to the humiliation of a nation under occupation, who'd had German boyfriends. And when I grew up, you still knew exactly, you can't go and buy sweets at that tobacconist because she had been, you know, had a German soldier boyfriend and so on. So it lasted for quite a long time. Same in Asia. There wasn't very much Chinese revenge against the Japanese. Even though they had ample reason to feel vengeful, it was against other Chinese. In the Dutch East Indies and Malaya, the vengeance was not so much against the colonial power, it was against people who were associated with the colonial power, local people, Ambanese, Chinese, and so on and so forth. So, the worst, the most brutal example of revenge was the ethnic cleansing in Poland and in Czechoslovakia, where the local German population was expelled under with maximum brutality. But they, of course, also, in a sense, were part of the same people. They were ethnically and linguistically different. And again, class. I mean, the Germans in cities like Breslau or in the Sudetenland, they were the professors, the lawyers, the doctors. And so there was a revolutionary element behind the vengeance against the Germans there too.
So I guess when I was talking about ambiguity, I was thinking about the way in which you really interrogate the idea of collaboration and what it means. And because this is a truly international book, part of the pleasure of it is the specificity, that you're tracking what happens in different countries. And so collaboration might mean something different in a colonial context in Europe, for example.
Well, to take the Dutch East Indies as an example, or Burma for that matter, local nationalists, anti-colonial nationalists, saw the Japanese occupation and were encouraged to think so by the Japanese, as a chance to get rid of the former colonial masters. And the easy defeat of the British and the Dutch and the French in Southeast Asia also showed that the white masters were vulnerable. And so they collaborated with the Japanese, Sukarno in the Dutch East Indies, or same in other colonies, for nationalistic reasons. But the Europeans in 45 were told that these were like Nazi collaborators. And so they, an intense effort was made to crush these independence movements. And a lot of soldiers who were sent to Southeast Asia to crush them were people who themselves had been in the anti-Nazi resistance. The same in North Africa with French troops. And so Sukarno in the Dutch East Indies, later Indonesia, in Indonesian eyes was a nationalist. In Dutch eyes, in those days, he was a collaborator. And so, yeah, that was a very ambivalent and complicated situation.
But in World War One, Indian troops, for example, served as part of the Imperial forces and at the end of the war felt they had shown themselves worthy, and arguably this was one of the important beginnings of moves towards Indian independence. So how then are you, because your whole book is arguing that 1945 is the pivotal point of change rather than, say, 1918. So what's different? Why not make a similar case for 1918 or 19, perhaps?
Well, I don't know if in 1919 Europeans or, for that matter, Americans in the Philippines seriously thought of independence in the colonies. I think there were certainly ideas that they had to be slowly educated so that eventually they might be able to take care of themselves, but they still needed the steady guiding hand of Western powers. So it wasn't really an acute issue then, whereas in 45 it really was, and the nationalists, the independence movements in the colonies saw that they not only had the right to take over, but that they very possibly could. And again, that's Japanese nationalists today like to justify their war partly by claiming that they liberated Asia. After all, you know, after the Japanese invasions, that's when the colonies were finally gradually became independent. This is a rather self-serving argument, of course. It wasn't the Japanese intention to really make Asian countries independent. They wanted to be a new colonial power. But in effect, they're right. Because it showed that the white man was not all powerful. You can, I mean, part of one way that you can control countries is not just by military force, because there weren't all that many, the armies or European armies in the colonies were not very big, but it relied on the compliance of the colonized people, who believed, whether they liked it or not, this was the natural order of things, that the white man was invincible. And the Japanese showed very clearly that this was not the case, and often made a point of showing them that. I mean, one of the things in the Burma Railroad and in POW camps that the Japanese liked to do was to humiliate white soldiers in front of Malays and others to show that they could sort of kick the white man when he was down. Having said that, it's also true, and this is often forgotten by Europeans, that the Asians, Asian POWs and Asian slave workers on the Burma Railroad were treated far, far worse than the white folks, as they say in America.
Okay, let's go to 1945 then, liberation. This was itself a very odd experience, which you describe as it happens all around the world. And it begins with an exaltation that you describe as, in some places, almost erotic.
Yes, not almost erotic. It was erotic because, and Australians had this experience during the war a little bit, when there were large numbers of American soldiers who, you know, had more money than local boys and had better teeth and so on. And silk stockings, and so they had that pick of the local beauties. And when large numbers of Americans and Canadians and Tommies came into newly liberated countries in Western Europe, it was almost like a kind of, it only lasted for a few months, but it was like a kind of an orgiastic celebration of liberation with the background of Glenn Miller music and so on. And much to the chagrin of the local boys, who, again, were underfed, demoralized, or away, dancings for Allied personnel in cities like Amsterdam said that local boys were not allowed to come in, and Dutch girls were only allowed to come in with, you know, Canadians. And I read that somewhere that in Paris, where you had Allied troops of all kinds, local women, the first choice was the Americans. If they couldn't get a Yank, they'd go for a Canadian. And but they were all very popular because they were sort of sunburnt, they had sharp uniforms, they had Hershey bars, they had rations, they had stockings and so on. So they were like rock stars. Now, the other thing you're probably alluding to is that there was an enormous amount of sex in the camps after they were liberated. And again, it's maybe a human urge to follow death and the proximity of death with procreation, just as a sort of a biological urge.
But there was real discomfort there, wasn't there, about how survivors were expected to behave?
Yes. Well, they were expected to behave sort of in a docile and cooperative manner, and of course many of these people were very traumatized and were difficult. But just to finish that point, in camps like Bergen-Belsen and so on, where there were Jewish survivors of the death camps often, the Zionist organizations very quickly went in and organized kibbutzim. They were the first kibbutzim were in the concentration camps, not in Israel. And it was a policy. Condoms were not allowed to be handed out because it was a policy that they should have babies as quickly as possible. And as a very human, it was often seen by social workers and foreign military personnel and so on as somehow degenerate and disgusting behavior. Actually, it was partly people had lost their families, they'd lost their friends, and it was partly a reaching out to human contact again and love. And partly it was really to keep mankind going after it had been so grievously damaged.
Well, we've talked about exaltation then. Let's talk about vengeance, because sometimes that was enacted very quickly and without any process. Did this happen in some places or under some circumstances more than others?
Yes. If you wanted to restore order, of course you had to get vengeance under control, because otherwise you get sort of mobs going on a rampage, and which was not always easy. My own view is that even though a lot of vengeance concerns people settling scores, personal scores often, when it takes place on a large scale, it's almost always because of political manipulation. There are agendas there. And as I said earlier, I think in Eastern Europe, it was part of the revolutionary project of in the satellite states of the Soviet Union, or countries that became satellite states like Poland and Czechoslovakia. I think there was a strong revolutionary element in vengeance against class enemies as well as against real wartime enemies.
And you say, though, that it was played out very differently in places like Japan and even Korea, for example, in the way that they were responding to what had happened to them under the Japanese, and that you see, if I understand your argument correctly, that you see this as part of a different politic in comparison to, say, the Soviet response to vengeance.
Well, in China, people were not so much concentrated on the Japanese anymore, and that became a kind of sideshow. The real issue in China was the Civil War. So if you were a nationalist or a communist, it was your fellow Chinese on the other side who were the focus of your efforts, and the Japanese didn't really matter anymore. In fact, the Japanese were used by the nationalists often to fight on their side against the communists. And again, in Southeast Asia, there were very strange and ironic consequences of the end of the war too, which was that when the nationalist independence movements began, and that often also happened with a lot of violence, and criminal elements came into it, and there were mobs and so on, the European POWs in former Japanese POW camps had to be protected against the local people by Japanese guards. And that happened in Vietnam, in Indochina as well. And so that was an odd situation.
Well, you mentioned the criminal elements, and the criminal aspects of World War II also had to be addressed at the end of the war. And I'm thinking of things like the black market, profiteering, and even the very complicated sort of sexual economy. None of these things disappeared in 1945 with the end of the war. So how could those things that had become such a strong element of some cultures, how could they be integrated into this new world in 1945?
Well, in some cases, black marketeering and... the problem is that the world was in complete chaos. Industry was destroyed, bombed out, cities were smashed. There was no normal economy. And so what happens then is that people, in order to survive, create a kind of economy, and that's a black market economy, and gives the chance to all kinds of gangsters to profit. But people needed these black markets and so on simply to survive. So it wasn't so much that it was a hangover of what was going on during the war. It was a consequence of the destruction of war that you had these things. And it lasted in some way, some countries, for quite a long time. In other countries, things got normalized quicker. In terms of occupation, I mean, prostitution, of course, was very much part of this too, because it was a way to survive. It's the most primitive form of capitalism, if you like, prostitution. It's the most basic transaction, after all. And in occupied countries, the defeated nations, Japan, for example, the first people who had close contact with the Allied occupying forces were the prostitutes. And they were envied for this and despised by other Japanese because they had access to goodies, and they were the ones who came up with a sort of pidgin English language full of GI terms and so on, and they were the first ones to learn to speak English almost. So it was a weird topsy-turvy world that for most people was very distressing. It was not without its excitement. And had a profound effect, of course, in all these countries.
And you do tell extremely distressing stories about what was happening under Russian occupation in particular, and particularly to women. And again, this certainly didn't end in 1945. In some ways, it began again.
Yes, I mean, what the Soviet army did was in many ways an example of atrocities that were deliberately sort of encouraged and stirred up. Stalin and his generals very deliberately told the Soviet Red Army soldiers who moved to the West into Germany and German-held territories were told to do their worst. And they did do their worst, and it should always be borne in mind that however badly they behaved, it was still not nearly as bad as what the Germans did to them. And so one has to see this in proportion. But one thing that played a role in this, and it wasn't just when Soviet troops moved into Germany, it was also in Manchuria, which was a Japanese puppet state, very heavily industrialized puppet state. A lot of these soldiers were dirt poor, came from villages where they've never seen electricity. And to them, going into the bombed out cities of Germany, where there was almost nothing left, to them what they saw was still a life of indescribable luxury, just because they had light bulbs and running water still here and there, and it sent them into a kind of rage, again a rage that was officially encouraged, but it was a rage because they felt, you know, these Germans have behaved like absolute beasts to us. And look how well off they are compared to us. And so that added to the animus of... they wanted to it was payback time.
On RN and online at abc.net.au/RN, this is Big Ideas. And tonight, a conversation with Ian Buruma about his latest book, Year Zero, A History of 1945. Ian Buruma is an historian, author and professor of human rights at Bard College in New York. Let's head back to the City Writers Festival to continue the discussion. Here's RN's Kate Evans.
You mentioned the sheer awfulness of what happened. Again and again, I think that's one of the central themes of your book, is how far in 1945 people had to work out the language, the description, how to address, even imaginatively, just how to try to understand what had happened, particularly with the final solution. And they didn't always do it well, did they? But is it that it was so unimaginable?
Yes, I think there's a big difference between knowing the facts and knowing. The British philosopher, or Russian-British philosopher, Isaiah Berlin, has always fascinated me because he was in Washington, D.C., in the British Embassy, and he was the liaison man with the Zionist leadership, Chaim Weizmann in particular. And he always maintained that he didn't know, hadn't really known the full extent of the Holocaust, the death camps and so on, until after the war, which is very hard to imagine, since Anthony Eden gave a speech in the Parliament in Westminster, I think it was in 1942, where he actually talks about the mass murder of Jews in Poland and so on. And Anne Frank mentions it in her diary, the gas chambers. So you would think, you know, Anne Frank, this, you know, little Jewish girl in an attic, listening to the BBC radio, she knew, and Isaiah Berlin did not. Nonetheless, it may actually be true that he knew the facts, but it was so unimaginable that he couldn't really wrap his head around it until later. And that was probably true of a lot of people. I mean, and of course, people often don't have the imagination to imagine the unimaginable, and nor do they want to. But you're right, during the war crime trials in Nuremberg, what was later known as the Holocaust was very much mentioned, but it was not the central issue that it is. It really only became in the 1960s.
Well, you trace a whole series of processes in that, the sense-making of what had happened, and some of it was at a more personal level and some of it was at a legal level. If we could just stop at the sort of the personal level, in a way, German people were brought into the camps to look at them, to see what had happened. There was enormous resistance to this process. What was it meant to do? What was the purpose of it?
I think it probably was what may be an illusion, but it was part of, I mean, we've been talking so far about things that are not particularly uplifting for a Sunday morning. But there was an enormous amount of optimism and idealism that came out of this massive destruction of the war as well. The idea that we have to now create a better world, a more just world, a more equal world. People have to learn from these terrible experiences and become better people. And I think I'm not optimistic about this idea, but it's a noble idea. I think that it was widely felt that if people could see the extent of human bestiality, they would learn to behave better. And the first people who had to be taught this lesson were, of course, the people who themselves were perpetrators or in whose name these atrocities had been carried out, namely the Germans. To contradict myself a little bit, it may have had some effect in that right now, if you look at the various participants in World War II, the two peoples who are most reluctant to use military force under any circumstances are the Germans and the Japanese. And so to some, especially neoconservatives in the United States, it is felt that they learnt their lessons too well. But lessons were learned. So I'm contradicting myself, which can only lead to further thought.
But you do say that this was part of a process to address the idea, never again. This must happen never again. But then you sort of take that idea apart and show us that the idea of never again meant different things in different places to different social and political groups. Is it never again colonialism? Is it never again this particular solution? So what does that phrase mean to you, never again, in 1945?
Well, as you say, I think it did mean different things to different people. It has had some unfortunate consequences too, which is that history, of course, never repeats itself in exactly the same way. One unfortunate consequence of this, the sort of never again notion is that people use history over and over again, I mean, up to our own time, to argue for particular policies. And so Munich in 1938, when the Sudetenland was given up by Neville Chamberlain, and the appeasement policy is used as a never-again moment over and over. Every time there's a tin pot dictator in the Middle East who has to be resisted, and if, to some people, if military force is not immediately used to intervene, we get Munich, never-again appeasement, and so on. I think this is a dangerous notion because however bad, let's say, Assad is in Syria, it's not 1938. And you're not being Neville Chamberlain by saying that it might be unwise to get involved in a civil war there. I mean, there are perfectly good arguments maybe for why one should, but I think one should leave Neville Chamberlain out of it. He should be allowed to rest in peace by now. But people don't. And so they use this never again argument. I mean, again, dictators are constantly being compared to Hitler. Hillary Clinton very recently compared what Putin's shenanigans in the Ukraine to Hitler and the Sudetenland, which is not to excuse in any way or manner what Putin is up to. It's clearly it's dangerous. There are echoes of the past, but by saying we have to intervene because otherwise it's Munich is the wrong way of applying never again.
And because one of the things that has changed is a legal framework for dealing with war crimes and various other things. But in 1945, there was no legal framework. And so you track some frankly ridiculous legal arguments that as they were trying to work out how to address war crimes. And a lot of the problem was a military model.
Yes, it wasn't necessarily so ridiculous because it was a real problem. What they had were war crimes, the Geneva Conventions and so on. What the Nazis had done went so far beyond conventional war crimes that they had to find some kind of legal language to deal with this. Why do we have war crime trials? Well, the ancient Greeks already understood that one of the functions of a trial, a public trial, is that it prevents revenge, the revenge of the Furies. The Furies will keep coming back if you don't put a stop to it by having a trial. And so they had to do something, but not everybody believed that they had to do what was eventually done. Winston Churchill was not the only one who felt that the Nazi leaders should simply be put up against the wall and shot. Because he felt a trial would simply degrade the whole legal process. Let's get on with it, shoot the buggers, and wash our hands of the whole affair. But that's, ironically, it was the Soviets who were most keen on having a trial with their rich experience of show trials and wanting things to look legal and so on. So there you had bloody Soviet judges who had been involved in terrible show trials under Stalin, who were on the Nuremberg Tribunal judging the Nazis, which of course did discredit it somewhat. But you had to have trials because for some kind of sense of justice to be felt, to be done, you couldn't go after all the Germans and their collaborators who had blood on their hands. So that would have meant going after millions and millions of people. It would have torn societies apart. You couldn't restore order in a world if you did that. So you had the trial has a symbolic function. And one of the things that was invented for the Nuremberg trials was the crimes against humanity, because that was a new legal concept to deal with systematic mass murder that goes well beyond war crimes. And yes, it's unfortunate, although it's hard to feel sorry for Julius Streicher and Hermann Göring and all the other gang, but they were, of course, tried according to laws that had not existed when they perpetrated their crimes. But, I mean, the point, of course, is not whether one should feel sorry for Hermann Göring. The point was whether this was a wise move as a sort of a normative process so that future generations could be judged according to the same criteria. And, well, it's still a mess. We have an international war crime tribunal in The Hague. These are things that are still contested. But in my view, it was still probably better to have had those trials than not. If only because they set a kind of precedent and a model. And the Germans themselves began to have war crime trials in the 1960s, and they wouldn't have done that if it hadn't been for Nuremberg.
So many things were set in place in that year, in 1945. Was it also the key time for imagining a new future, a new beginning? I mean, do you see it as a positive year in a sense as well, even though, you know, it's about dealing with an immediate horrifying aftermath?
Yes, because two reasons, apart from my father's story, but two reasons that I was impelled to write this book. One of the reasons was that we've been embarking on wars recently. Wars started and promoted by people who had no personal experience of war. The architects of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, apart from Donald Rumsfeld, who'd served in the Korean War, but none of them really had any personal experience with war. And I felt very strongly that they had not really thought through the consequences enough. They thought that if you topple a dictator, things will kind of sort themselves out. Or at worst, in Donald Rumsfeld's words, stuff happens, but, you know, things will be okay eventually. And I don't think they had realized that even just wars, and World War II was a just war, in my view, have catastrophic consequences. So that was one reason I wanted to write it. The other reason is that the idealism to create a better world of nations that cooperate in the United Nations, in a united Europe, the welfare state, redistribution of wealth, and all these things, that they're coming apart at the seams very fast now. And it's understandable that generations who no longer have the same anxieties and the same experiences as the generation that came out of World War II would no longer feel the same sense of urgency and idealism. That's very perfectly understandable. But I think that the post-war, the 1945 order is unraveling. And I think the consequences may not be so pretty. We see it in the widespread cynicism in Europe about the EU, the rise of right-wing populist parties, the distrust of democracy, which is becoming very widespread, and so on. So, that's the other reason. So, just to come back to your question, yes, there was that idealism, which led to a kind of post-war consensus, and it's disappearing.
Well, just to pause on the EU for a moment, you say at one point in your book, the main monument of post-war planning is Europe itself. What do you mean by that?
Well, that one of the main reasons for the drive to unite Europe was to make sure Germany and France never went to war again. That was really the heart of it. So the heartland of the EU is the border area of France and Germany, which were the sources of so much bloodshed in the last 150 years or so. And in that sense, I think it really has been a resounding success. I mean, nobody in Europe can imagine anymore that any major European power would go to war with another. And so, in that sense, it's a big success. But like all well-intentioned plans, they lay the seeds for future problems, usually. The architects behind the unified Europe were well-meaning, often French, sometimes German, usually Roman Catholic, idealists, technocrats, who dreamed of a world in which clever and well-intentioned men like themselves, who knew best what was good for people, could create a kind of an ideal community, and did not always have enough feeling for democracy, for consulting people, for making sure everybody's on board, and so on. So what we've got is now a union where citizens don't feel that they have any kind of democratic grip on affairs. People become very cynical, resentful, and all the anxieties of our age to do with failing economies and globalization and so on are now being projected on this very idealistic and noble mission undertaken by technocrats who are probably insufficiently democratic.
I'd just like to ask you one more question before we go to the floor, and that is a parochial one in Australian terms. It was probably felt here from 1946 rather than 1945, but the end of World War II meant, among other things for Australia, the arrival of displaced persons from Europe. And your dad was a DP at the end of the war as well. How important is that movement of refugees around the world for understanding 1945 as a pivotal year in world history?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. The movement of refugees, of course, has been hugely important, but that really already began before the war. I mean, if you just think of academic disciplines in the United States or intellectual life in the United States altogether, or Britain, the influence of Jewish refugees who came from Germany and Austria before the war has been immense. I'm sure that refugees who came in 1946... have probably by and large enriched Australian society too. It injects a great dosis of cosmopolitanism. It brings the rest of the world here. Many of the people were highly educated and so on. But I think it's very difficult to generalize from that because there are different waves of refugees. If you think, for example, of the refugees from the Vietnam War, you had waves of mostly Chinese, Sino-Vietnamese who were highly educated, middle class. You had waves of mountain people, Hmong and so on, who were from a very different social class, and the consequences of that are different. So I think you have to take each refugee question separately, really. It's difficult to sort of give one glib answer to that and say, you know, immigration is always good because it, you know, multiculturalism is wonderful and we have all these nice Chinese restaurants and Indian dances and isn't it great? I mean, I think there was a lot of that in the 1960s and 70s, and to some extent, rightly, there's been a reaction against that kind of Pollyanna-ish attitude.
Ian Baruma talking about his latest book, Year Zero, A History of 1945. On Big Ideas, we've got just some time for a few questions from the audience. Let's head back to the Sydney Writers Festival.
Ian Baruma, I've had the privilege of reading your book, and it's absolutely fantastic. I was familiar with some of your earlier work, including your novel, but this is, it's a tour de force, and I could only commend it to people. Just the range of it, Europe, Asia and everything, I thought was amazing. And I was actually a five-year-old in Europe in 1945, and it wasn't very nice where I was, but it was obviously a lot worse in a lot of other places. The thing that's always intrigued me, you know, with that background that I had, you mentioned Germany and Japan had the fact that they didn't want to be militarized to any great extent anymore in common. But the other issue about it was the Germans, they did political education for their people, they paid reparations to Israel, to individual Jews, you know, the whole thing. And I think I'm not sure, but I think they're probably still paying reparations to Israel, you'd know better than I. Whereas the Japanese do not seem to have acknowledged their role at all. And I learnt from your book, which I didn't know, that 10 million Chinese died. And, of course, now we've got Abe going to that shrine again. And, you know, it all seems to be happening again and nothing seems to have been learnt. So there seems to be a contrast there between those two, the losers of losers in the war, and I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Well, there are big differences. First of all, the German response. The East German response was not the same as the West German response. So when people talk about how well the Germans have coped with it, they're really talking about West Germany. One of the differences is that the Germans, when they talk about facing the past and reparations, it's almost entirely focused on the Holocaust. It's not about the invasion of Norway or anything like that. And the Japanese don't really have an exact equivalent of that. There was never a systematic ideological effort to wipe out an entire people. So their war was different. The other difference is that it's not the Japanese who have a particular view. The Japanese view has been very polarized along political lines ever since 1945. And that has a lot to do with the post-war order, in that the Americans wrote a pacifist constitution. Because in Germany, the thing to find out for the Allied authorities was what had gone wrong. Why did these countries do these things? In Germany, it was fairly simple. You had a Nazi regime, you had Hitler, you had a Nazi party. They came to power in 1933 and were out in 1945. Otherwise, it was, you know, a civilized European nation, the land of Mozart and Goethe and all that. So if you can purge the Nazis, you can more or less solve the German problem, so to speak. In Japan, there was no Nazi party, there was no Hitler. So the blame was militarism that was blamed, and the militarist culture and the samurai and so on. So you have to take militarism out of Japanese culture and society. That was the notion. And so they got a pacifist constitution. Most Japanese who were heartily sick of war or being bossed around by military authorities were quite happy with that. But there was a vociferous minority of right-wing nationalists who, not unjustly, saw it as robbing Japan of a very important part of its sovereignty, because it made Japan entirely dependent on the United States for its security, almost a vassal state. And so ever since this constitution was written, there's been an effort on the right to revise the constitution. Now, the main argument for the pacifist constitution held by the left or the center-left was always, look what we did during the war. We behaved like animals. Let's not be tempted again. Let's stick to our pacifist constitution. As long as they argued that, the right has to say, no, of course bad things happened during the war. All wars are terrible. We didn't do anything worse than other countries have in their history. It's all left-wing propaganda. Let's revise the constitution. In other words, history has become, it's a political argument disguised as a historical argument. So it's not that the Japanese are culturally or congenitally disposed to sweeping everything under the rug. It's that it was politicized in a way that didn't happen in Germany.
Different question. One of the things that's impressive about the book is the sweep of the global sweep of the book. And I wonder how one conceptualizes that in preparing to write it.
Well, yeah. One doesn't want to psychoanalyze oneself. I'm a rootless cosmopolitan, as Stalin would say. But one possible reason could be that I don't have the patience or the staying power or the mental capacity for concentration to find out a huge amount about one thing. So I'm more disposed, because I'm too impatient and get too quickly bored, I'm more disposed to finding a lot about out a little bit about a lot of things. So I'm happier looking at a lot of countries and then to become a sort of specialist in one thing, which may be a weakness, but it has its advantages.
Ian, thank you very much for a magnificent book and presentation. Year zero, 1945, in a way, are you saying it wiped the slate clean and we could start again? The United Nations was formed in that very year, and next year it is year 70. In your view, have we done anything in those 70 years in terms of war and peace which makes the world a safer place, would you say?
The concept of year zero is, of course, that's the way people like to see it then, that this was wiping the slate clean, which is, of course, always an illusion, because there's never a clean slate and history always trips you up and the past will never go away, and etc. Has it been a success? Well, like everything else, I think it's a mixed picture. One success is to repeat what I said earlier, that it's become inconceivable for Western Europe to tear itself apart again. So I think that is a success. In other ways, has it made the world safer? The Pax Americana, which came out of World War II, which has had its own wars, some of them very foolish wars, but it probably did, it was a period of relative safety in that there was very little chance of, well, there were the Cuban Missile Crisis and other periods could have made things go very badly wrong, but it was, my generation grew up, if you were lucky enough to be in the right places, grew up in a period of extraordinary peace and prosperity. And that was the result of decisions made after the war. But as I said, I think it's unraveling, and I'm not at all sanguine about what's going to come. But I suppose having a period of peace and prosperity is already, one should count one's blessings.
Because, Ian, you get to the end of that year, 1945, at the end of the book, and you say you come to that end on a mixed note of gratitude and anxiety, or that that's how the year came to an end. And so I wondered how ultimately, what you decided about that year. Was it, by the end of that year, a time of hope or just fragility?
Well, it's always a bit of both. I think if you only stress the hope, you're being foolishly naive. If you only stress the fragility, you're a kind of a doomsday artist. And I try and avoid both these extremes.
Is there a final question? There's one just down the front, right here.
I just wanted to talk to you about the trials of the Germans, and the impact of a public reckoning that they had, and then project forward to when the Americans caught Osama bin Laden and they deliberately didn't have a trial. Do you think that was wise? Do you think it said something about the way the world's changed, and it may have been better if they had have put him on trial in terms of public reckoning and politics?
I don't know, because I think it's a very murky story, and I don't know if one can prove that they deliberately shot him because they didn't want to put him on trial. It was such a fast and messy situation that who knows exactly would it have been better if he'd been put on trial? I'm not so sure. So that it would have been such an enlightening exercise, because he's the head of a sort of a semi-criminal terror organization, and there's not a huge amount to be learned by putting somebody like him on trial. It's not, whereas if you put somebody who's a head of a government and particularly of a tyrannical government on trial, you're not just putting a person on trial, you're also then, there's a lot to be learnt about systems of government which can lead to terrible violence and oppression. And so I would say that there's more point in putting those people on trial than a figure like bin Laden.
Ian Baruma, human rights professor at Bard College in New York. He was in conversation with RN's Kate Evans at this year's Sydney Writers' Festival, discussing his latest book, Year Zero, A History of 1945, published by Atlantic Books. And on the subject of Europe, you may have seen RN's free online magazine, White Paper. In this month's issue, you'll find an analysis of EU enlargement policies, the dynamics behind Europe's interest in Asia, the enduring legacy of Serge Gainsbourg, and more. You can download your free copy by visiting the RN homepage, abc.net.au/RN. And that's it for Big Ideas for tonight. Tomorrow night, cybersecurity, financial instability, epidemic diseases. We are increasingly facing problems of a global nature, yet global governance has so far failed to keep pace with the complexity of these challenges. Pascal Lamy, a former Director General of the World Trade Organization, puts forward his solution to the global governance deficit. That's Big Ideas tomorrow. Hope you can join me then. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.